On the Higher Side Chats, we explore the world's deepest conspiracies, its mysteries, and the all-around fringe on a quest that can't be sponsored by anyone but the loyal listeners looking to take that ride. So if you enjoy the first hour of the show, courtesy of those subscribers, we hope that you'll consider becoming one for just $5 a month, and you'll get a second hour of each THC episode where we pack in twice as much interesting content with all our great guests. Just sign up on our members' website at thehighersidechatsplus.com, and you'll have instant access to all the extended content since Plus began, an opportunity to make topics and guest suggestions, and your own custom RSS feed, where you'll hear the full two-hour show in one convenient, uninterrupted file. And most importantly, you won't hear this repetitive reminder at the start of every show that listener-supported communities are the future of media and entertainment. And you want to be part of that future, don't you?
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Drink a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood, doing what I do in sunny San Diego, and today is going to get pretty interesting. We did have a money bomb winner by the name of Mariah. I broke her off about $250, but we probably won't hear from her until next week. So let's just get weird right out of the gate. See, we all know that the various elements that make up reality are manipulated by an elite that goes back centuries, and in that time, there have been many opportunities to shape reality for the masses, warping and suppressing ancient texts that talk about our origins, covering up any ongoing connection to non-human entities, removing magic from the mainstream. And we get attached to the things that we think we know, the truths we've been taught from an early age, like the world is a big ball of nothing but rock beneath our feet in an iron core, or if the technology for free energy devices existed, they'd give it to us, or that giants never roamed the lands. Well, why wouldn't it be in school? Why wouldn't scientists tell us the truth? Why would universities, doctors, geologists, museums, politicians, government institutions, and multinational corporations lie to us? Well, they're all founded and funded by the old boys' banking priesthoods of however long ago. At least that's the broad strokes with which I paint my reality, and I think most people here are familiar with that outlook as well. And a major area of speculation and investigation on this journey to revealment is into NASA and the space programs of the world. Why does the Vatican have one of the most advanced observatories on the planet? Why are so many whistleblowers talking about bases on the moon and Mars and secret space fleets beyond what we're told is possible? Why does NASA use such cryptic names for their probes and missions? Why are all their photos and footage of major events being called into question, with researchers finding errors that make you wonder if entire missions even took place? Lots of questions, and some of these conspiracies are coming to a head with modern technology, and we're wondering why more people aren't getting great footage of Bigfoot or aliens on their phones, or how could there be bases on the moon when the technology to view it is getting into the hands of armchair astronomers? Why aren't people seeing stuff? Or if the Earth is really hollow, why haven't satellite operators and Google blown the whistle on it? Why can't we see those polar openings, for Christ's sake? I admit, a lot of these secrets seem almost too big to keep in 2015, and we've yet to really expose anything quite as shocking as the things I mentioned, but it's easy to forget how far back the shadowy elite might go. And it's easy to forget that these secret societies and bankster priesthoods have been molding, shaping, and forming the world around us back to Sumeria and beyond. I think it's easy to underestimate that type of advantage. Always being 50 steps ahead, knowing that any education, any technology, any scientific discovery is going to come from someone who has passed through the gatekeeper's guard to even have a telescope in the 17th century, to even have a PhD or credential of any kind. You have to go through their official channels, and your lens is thoroughly altered by their process, and a credential isn't as much a testament of your brilliant mind as much as it is your willingness to follow directions and take the textbook before you as the gospel truth, so help you God. Now, I bring all this to your attention so early in the game because we're going to explore some strange alternatives to the ideas that we have about our world, primarily one very radical possibility brought on by some interesting footage captured by today's guest, who wishes to remain anonymous to a large extent. He operates a YouTube channel under the name Crow777 with two R's, and included with this episode, you should find links or embeds to some of his videos that we talk about in the show. And the first half hour is interesting, but it's really just foreplay to get you warmed up and ready for some examination and speculation over Crow's holy grail of strange footage, the Lunar Wave. It's just the type of show I like to do, a unique perspective and strange ideas that break from the conspiracy herd, as well as a well-spoken, lucid guest. I think you'll love it. Usually when we talk about space in the conspiracy world, we're talking about a secret group being far more advanced, reaching farther into the vast universe than we're told on the surface. And today we're examining almost the polar opposite possibility, that we've done far less in space than we've been led to believe. And with that, I'll just drop you into the action. Exploring the wide range of anomalies and oddities captured through the lens of today's co-pilot, the man we call Crow. Enjoy.
Sweet dreams to the elite. We're calling them out on TAC. Uncovering secrets and conspiracies. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to abuse you. Some of them want to be abused.
Alright people, we know the planet's puppet masters have lied to us about nearly infinite things and rewritten history in many different ways, and we've explored some pretty fringe possibilities of what the underlying truth may be in some of these areas, some more far out than others, and today's guest wants to remain fairly anonymous, but goes by the name of Crow Online. You might have seen his YouTube channel, Crow777, where he has captured some pretty high-res footage of many strange UFOs and orbs in the sky, as well as something called the Lunar Wave, which has created quite a buzz in the conspiracy community. We're going to discuss these things, what they might mean for us, and what the larger implications might be. I know I'm excited to have him here. Welcome to the show, Crow.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, this is awesome. Thanks for doing it. I know you like your privacy, but at the same time, you've got some really interesting ideas about the true nature of reality that I think are going to be really fun to explore. And to get this started, you've got some great footage. Can you tell us about your process and the equipment you use at all?
Well, I started with a classic Meade telescope, which has an 8-inch aperture, and I had a Canon, which was 18 megapixels, a DSLR. That's how this all started, and as I got going, people took an interest in what I was shooting, and they kept urging me to do a crowdsourced funding to upgrade my equipment, which close to a year in, I actually did, and it succeeded, and I upgraded to a much bigger scope, and I use a Celestron now, and I got a much better camera. The camera that I use now is a Nikon D800, but what's special about it, besides the fact that it has 36 megapixels, which is beneficial in the editing room, allows you to really zoom in on things, is the pixels do not dither together. So on these objects that can be really small, if we're shooting the moon or something, the imagery has gotten a lot better. And to top it off, I've also upgraded to have an H-alpha solar telescope, which I am just beginning to use now. So that's where I'm at.
Right on, man. Good to know, because regardless of what you've captured, just the level of crisp detail in your videos is worth acknowledging, and it might be good info for anyone else wanting to become a sky watcher. So often people think they've captured amazing things, but the footage is so blurry or shaky, you can't even tell. And you've got that angle on lock, so I have to say kudos to you on that one at least, man.
Well, in this game, the truth is that resolution is king. If you produce shaky video, out-of-focus video, video that's just not that great, you're not really adding much to the conversation, because at the end of the day, you'll never be able to determine what you're looking at. So from the get-go, my aim has been to produce the highest quality I can, and everything I've shot to date is HD, but there are levels of HD. I mean, you can always get better.
Right, right. So to add a little bit more on the fire for people who might be skeptical about some of the things we're going to get into, do you have a background or any credentials that may lend credibility to your opinion or ability to interpret the footage you're getting? Can you go into that at all?
Well, I suppose in terms of being a part of a UFO community or something like that, no, not really. I've been a one-man show. I was a radio operator in the Marine Corps, And I've been into astronomy. I got that, the first scope that I described to you, I got that in the mid-90s, right before the Hale-Bopp comet came around. And I've been doing it ever since. So I guess the only real credential that I can claim is experience, that I have literally many thousands of hours of viewing time. And since I've been filming, probably many more thousands of hours. There are very few people that I know or I am aware of who have put in the hours for even just moon observation that I have. One guy that comes to mind is Bill Bryson, but I don't think he's posted anything on YouTube in over a year. But there's another man who put in literally thousands of hours, and he came to the conclusion that when we look at the moon, we're not looking at what we've been told. And I think there's one other guy I was aware of, but I don't even remember his name at this point. He hasn't posted in so long.
Before we get into the really wild stuff, you have caught a lot of odd-looking UFOs. What do you think some of these things could be? Do you have any idea?
I think the simple explanation for almost everything I've shot is human technology. And while, you know, I don't discount the possibility that there's other beings out there. As a matter of fact, I would find it strange if I found out that there were no others besides us. But having said that, to make the claim that you're looking at an alien craft, I mean, you need to have evidence to do that. And I have shot some strange things that leave a lot of questions up in the air. But at the end of the day, I opt to start at human technology and then work from there.
Right on. So can you tell the people maybe about some of the things you've captured that are kind of shocking or might be beyond what we're told our level of technology should be? Because there's some pretty far out stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I have a number of clips that kind of fit that description, but I think one, it's one of my more popular clips. It's titled The Shooting Orb. Now, I kind of split my time between nighttime shooting, a lot of moon work, and daytime shooting. And in the daytime shooting, I cover chemtrails because it is such a huge concern now. You know, there's a lot of people that are not aware that this is going on and have been told that we're looking at contrails. For those of us that have put in the time to actually do the field work, look up, film, watch what's going on, we understand that there are planes overhead spraying things. Having said that, quite often, when we're filming chemtrails, we get what's called orbs or other unidentifiable things flying around. Now, if there was something that I shot that is hard to imagine as human technology, I would say the shooting orb clip is it. It looks like a ball of light, and it travels down into a chemtrail. There were tons of them in the sky that day, and what was unusual about that day is we could see them with our eyes. We knew that we were filming them. Quite often, we don't know we've caught anything till we're reviewing the video. But on this day, we knew we were shooting orbs because we could see them. And so this orb travels into the chemtrail, and it literally fires a beam or a plasma or something. It fires it twice, and you can see it very clearly in the clip. That one's hard to explain because if it is human tech, it's tech that I can't compare it to anything I've ever been aware of. So I think of all my clips, that one really stands out.
Yeah, that is an intense one. And outside of that clip, are you seeing a larger scale connection between orbs in the sky and chemtrails?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt. We don't know, or I don't know everything I would like to know, but I have spent so many hours shooting in the daytime. I have never shot an orb of any kind when chemtrails were not present. So I think there's a direct correlation. Now the question becomes, are they with the chem planes? Are the chem planes dropping them off? And I don't think that's the case because we have filmed them quite a ways away from chemtrails, heading towards them, and we've also filmed them leaving chemtrails and going just straight up until we can't see them anymore. So I know that's not a lot to go on, but that's kind of where we're at right now, just really wondering what the origin of these things is.
Yeah, it is very far out, and there are, I guess, far out possibilities for it. You know, the motif that there are ET races that are helping humanity from behind the scenes, I mean, that was the major motif behind the idea of crop circles. Do you get any indication that they might be doing some type of cleanup of chemtrails in a covert way?
Well, I can say this. I have seen footage online of others who clearly have caught orbs, and it looks like the trails are dissipating around the orbs. to some degree, I've kind of felt that way as I filmed them. I don't get a dark feeling. You know, when I'm filming chem planes, I kind of have a dark feeling because in my heart I'm thinking, this isn't good for us. But when I see the orbs, I don't get a negative perception of them per se, and they absolutely are attracted in the chemtrails. And if I had to guess, I would guess, and this is a flat-out guess, that they are not with the chem planes. But again, that's just the best guess I can give.
Right, right. It's all speculation at this point. But since the biggest factor in the chemtrail debate is identifying the difference between chemtrails and contrails, can you give us any clarity there that might help people who are kind of on the fence with that one?
Well, to be honest, the whole contrail argument really isn't very valuable. It's a disinformation thing. I mean, you're talking about ice crystals. A lot of times you'll see the plane's trail change or shut off. I've got footage on my YouTube channel of the trail just stopping and then starting again. Seems unlikely that a contrail would do that. A lot of times, I'm in Southern California like you, you know, we're looking at 10 to 15% humidity. And although I understand humidity levels can be different at different altitudes, I've lived here my whole life, and this is basically a chaparral desert. And when the humidity is really low, you don't see clouds, and yet we see these trails. And the real problem comes in is that we see them spraying in a couple ways. The really persistent trails that you see, they stay around for hours, and then they kind of spread out and turn the sky milky. But we see a lot of really high-altitude spraying, and using flight radar, we know that these planes are over 40,000 feet. So, I mean, what is that? That's like 7.5 miles or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're spraying a non-persistent chemtrail, but it's like this powdery junk that falls down and mixes. And again, it has the same effect. The whole sky either becomes shiny or a milky white. The main thing that I can say about contrails is I live in a flight path, and you're in San Diego too, so you understand how many planes are coming in and out of here.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm positioned so that all inbound traffic is south of me and all outbound traffic is north of me. And then there's a big circle all the way around me when they're in a flight pattern to land. And we have never, ever seen these commercial planes leave a trail of any kind, contrail or otherwise. And there's also the argument, you know, a lot of people have come and post on my site snippets from different websites claiming that modern jet engines don't leave contrails. I don't know if that's true, but we don't see contrails on commercial airliners. I know that for a fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, as somebody who has been keeping an eye on the sky for so long, have you seen chemtrails increase over the years, just in general?
Yeah, I mean, even today, I'm sitting outside right now, and there's a powdery look, and we saw them flying over 40,000 feet. Matter of fact, I wanted to start filming, but I had to come jump on a phone to do this with you. And it's the powdery, non-persistent stuff. And right now, oh, there's one going over the sun right now. There's a chem plane spraying over the sun at this very minute, and you will look up in the sky right now, and the sun is completely blotted out, but the rest of the sky is reasonably blue. Yeah, there's an increase. It's almost nonstop at this point.
In one of your videos, I did think it was interesting as for the argument about commercial airliners not doing this. One of the planes in one of your videos looks completely unmarked, which I thought was really odd. It just looks like a white plane.
We get that a lot. There's a few different types of planes that do this. And to be honest with you, we have filmed Virgin planes, which I know do commercial jobs as well, but we have seen Virgin planes leaving trails and a lot of really high ones that seem to have no numbers, no nothing, and occasionally they look plain, but there might be a single stripe, occasionally a red or a blue stripe. Some of them look like big tanker type military planes as well that again have no, you know, indicative markings that you can see. Part of the problem with that is we don't always have the best angle to see them because we're way down here. And even though I'm using a telephoto with a doubler on it, you know, you're looking at something that's at times beyond 7 miles away from me. I mean, if you think about a plane, it's 60,000 feet. I'm doing the math in my head. What is that? Something like 9 miles or something like that? I mean, that's a hell of a distance to shoot.
Yeah.
And also, we noticed that the color of these planes doesn't help. Sometimes, you know, you see all these postings on YouTube where people say, oh, it's a holographic plane or there is no plane. Well, I've used a telescope and I've used a telephoto to film these guys. And what I can tell you is when they're high enough, just the paint job on them makes them darn near invisible.
Mm-hmm. And you have captured what looks to be some type of cloaked plane before too, right?
Yeah, that was a little while ago, and it was unfortunate because I was using I didn't have time to set up my tripod because it was happening so quickly. I was trying to get a chem plane. And so when you're using a telephoto with a doubler, if you're not on a tripod, every jiggle translates into the video. But what happened was is I filmed the chemtrail, and then when I got in the editing room, I saw something cross the chemtrail at a lower altitude, and it almost looks like it's got one of these adaptive paint jobs or something. It was much lower than the chem plane, and I couldn't see it with my eye, and then in the editing room, I could barely see it. And I did title that clip cloaked plane, though I would imagine it's probably some kind of adaptive paint job or some, you know, something about the skin of the plane that just makes it near impossible to see.
Yeah, that one's pretty far out. I haven't seen much like that. And there was also some type of, I think you called it a chem tracking device that you caught here in San Diego. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that day, it was before I had upgraded my equipment, and we had the 8-inch out, and we were determined to film the chem planes with an 8-inch telescope, which is a very difficult thing to do because telescopes are not made to track a moving object. But my wife, who does this with me, has very good eyes, and she spotted what we thought was an orb. And so I was scrambling to get the telescope on it, and by pure luck, I managed to. And we thought we were looking at an orb for the first time at really high magnification. We were really excited about it. Perfectly round, no tether, kind of a glowing look to it. But what happened is as we filmed it, it blew up in midair. And then all this debris came out of it, and this kind of red ember-looking glowing thing fell. And we tracked it as far as we could till the roof blocked it. But when I reviewed the footage, I realized that it was akin to a weather balloon. But the strange thing is, we were out there when there were two chem planes that had flown at a very low altitude. We saw the first one, ran in, got the scope, drug it out, got all set up, and when the second plane flew by, this object appeared just under that second plane's path. I mean, we're reasonably sure that that was dropped by the second plane. And we did look into weather balloons, and we found that you're not supposed to launch weather balloons in a flight path, which we are in a flight path, and there's all these other rules. I guess you're supposed to be able to terminate the flight in a couple different ways. You're supposed to report every so many minutes. But although we did not see the plane drop it, for the life of us, we're like 90-some percent sure that that second plane dropped it. And then reviewing the video, we could see that there was like a tethered device that was like a red ember that fell. And so I just assumed that it was probably some kind of a tracking device to give them data on what they're about.
Hmm. Man, that is so interesting. So what do you think is the purpose or the agenda behind chemtrails? There's a lot of different theories out there. Where are you lying on this one?
Well, I think part of the problem with chemtrails is too many people are really wildly speculating, which I don't think helps people to understand that this is a real thing. People that have families and jobs mm-hmm. and don't have time in their life to go out and determine, you know, what's going on above my head. Having said that, there's so much deception in the times we live in, and I have come to understand that when we see the powers that be doing deceptive things, they usually have many purposes. It's not often that I recognize some deception that isn't doing two or three or four or more things at one time. Mm-hmm. I think the apex reasonable assumption here is that weather modification is going on. There are plenty of bills you can look up. China has launched a weather modification bureau. They were actively going to change their weather during the last Olympics that was in China. These are all documented things you can look up. But beyond that, you know, lab reports from around the world. And this is where the conversation gets dicey, because people like to come in and say, well, those are unprofessional lab reports, and they make many arguments. But at the end of the day, we're seeing three common heavy metals. in most of the reporting that's been done by private individuals. And even like Tahoe, I had read an article about, I don't know whether it was aluminum or barium, I forget what it was, but one of these chemtrail-related metals, the level of that going up in Lake Tahoe. So when I'm standing out here now looking at the sun blotted out, I can also begin to imagine that blocking sunlight has an effect beyond weather. What that is, I'm not really willing to speculate, because I would prefer that people understand something is going on than to provide a wild ass guess and, you know, have them shut their ears to the matter and not understand.
That's true, but I mean, we have seen a lot of science about vitamin D and how important that is. There's a lot of speculation that even just keeping people inside, corralled in little cubicles and under fluorescent lights and away from the sun, that alone has an effect. So I could see taking that to the extreme, trying to block out the sun in some way to decrease the level of vitamin D. If you're trying to make everybody sick with some type of depopulation agenda, I feel like that would fit in that wheelhouse.
I think there's, you can't really deny that. We know for a fact that the chemtrails are blocking huge amounts of sunlight that would have otherwise come down to us. There's really no arguing that. The point is proving intent. That's a whole other thing, and that's what makes all this so difficult. But I kind of feel like we are coming to a point where the whole global warming argument that was started so many years ago, this is all going to tie together, and I think that it's going to be opening up more, where they're going to come at it like we didn't have a choice, you know, the planet was going to catch on fire or, you know, melt or whatever their argument for the day is. I think that's going to be one of the big excuses that's used. Now, some of my friends that I'm close with that do a lot of research have claimed they've read documents that state from the powers that be, once they started doing this, under no circumstances could they stop. And the problem with that was there wasn't a lot more information to go with it. But, you know, if we consider that this has been going on since probably at least 96, and now, at least where I live, there's really not a week you can't go out and see it going on every day. Yeah, something's afoot, and if the lab reports are even close to correct, that's not good for us. Having huge amounts of sunlight reflected off us, that's not good for us. It's easy to say correctly this is not good for us. It's very difficult to talk about intent and why it's being done.
It is. And there is a lot of speculation out there that chemtrails might have some type of connection with, like, the HAARP array. Have you seen any indicator that that would be true outside of just speculation?
Well, I can, and actually I do have a background in radio. One of the things we did in radio was bounce radio waves off the ionosphere, and we would bounce them off the ocean. Say we were, you know, in Japan or Florida or something, and we wanted to bounce a signal to a new continent. That's kind of how you would go at it, depending on the type of radio you're using. But what we see here firsthand, and I believe I've got footage of this up somewhere, is you'll begin to see a frequency pattern in the cloud cover that the chemtrails have made. It looks kind of like beach sand. And the problem with that is people will say, oh, well, the wind does that. Well, the real problem with it is for those of us that pay attention and film and observe, it happens in very confined areas, and you'll see these frequency patterns. So I don't doubt for a second that these false ceilings of clouds that are being put in could be used to bounce radio waves around.
Wow, that's scary. But it's interesting that you actually have a background that has done things like bouncing radio waves off the ionosphere. So is there any other element to the whole HAARP conspiracy that you could possibly shed some light on because of your background?
Well, the real problem with trying to do any research on HAARP is that it is such an upfront topic that you get a ton of absolute crazy and a ton of absolute denial. So to find any middle ground there becomes very difficult. But, I mean, again, these are things that you can look up, where weather modification as a means of warfare, I think that started up openly, where you could see documents. I think it's the 80s, don't quote me, but there are documents that you can find about governments, you know, intending to modify weather for warfare, and that has been associated with HARP installations and other installations like it in other countries. So I don't think that's far-fetched to consider that these things have gone on.
Man.
And we also know, you know, really low frequency, I guess they call it ELF, ELF, extremely low frequency radio waves has some really dire effects on human beings, depending on how they're used and the amount of exposure, you get.
Yeah, that doesn't sound great either. I wanted to ask you about one particular UFO video you have that is really interesting, but it kind of looks like a gliding bird in front of the moon. I think you call it the boomerang UFO. What makes you think that wasn't a gliding bird? Is it because of the distance from the camera?
Well, yeah, it's definitely. So I have a Schmidt cast grain style scope. My old scope was that style and this one. So most people don't understand, because they've never used one, how the focus works. I can, as an example, I can set up my scope at night, point it at the moon, and put my head, you know, a foot away from the aperture in front of the scope, and you don't see a head. You see the light dim.
Hmm.
That's what you see. So when birds go by, they have to be... Well, I've got pictures. Here's a good example. I've got images of planes that I shot just by chance as I was filming the moon. Some of them are in perfect focus, and some of them are not quite in focus, and yet they're 2-3 miles away from me. So to gain focus on something with this style telescope, they have to be quite a ways away, and I've posted many pictures of birds so people can see what that looks like. For the most part, they go through frame very quickly, and they're see-through because they're not in focus. This object is absolutely in a weightless environment, or flying as if it was weightless. I guess that's a better way to say it. And it was absolutely at distance because it's as in focus as the moon behind it is. But what's crazy about that object is this is kind of the genesis story of how Crow started. It was the supermoon of 2012, and I had family over. We were going to watch the moon just optically through the scope. My nephew at one point said, "Hey, there's triangles tumbling in front of the moon." So, of course, we all took our turn, and each one of us saw these objects. Tons of them. What's crazy about this is we viewed for 2 to 3 hours, and anyone who watches the moon knows from our point of view, the moon appears to move over that time. Yet these triangular objects remained between us and the moon. We saw, I don't even know how many, and at one point my brother-in-law saw a formation of 5 to 7 of them, and we were blown away. And that's what, next day I went out and got the stuff I needed to begin to film. Now we're assuming that object that you're referring to is an object like that, because it is triangular. We saw the first ones through an eyepiece, so we probably had a bit crisper view. But what you'll see is it spins one way, spins the other way, noses down, noses up, clearly under intelligent control. And I do have varying versions of that clip that I've zoomed in on. It's absolutely technology of some kind, and it's absolutely under intelligent control. What it is, that's that's a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm. And another point to draw away from the idea that it could be a bird, can you get any indication of scale or size? Is this thing seems like, because of the distance, it'd be way too big to be a bird. It'd be like more plane size. Am I crazy?
Let's look at it this way. If it is in low Earth orbit, and I should state for the record, I have never, to my knowledge, shot anything anywhere near the moon. I have shot nothing in lunar orbit. I have shot nothing over the face of the moon. And the problem is that the way that I title videos to get people to watch them usually has the word moon or UFO in the same thing. But you've got to understand that we are told the moon is 250,000 miles away, okay? Now, I do know the pixel value of my camera, the old setup and the new setup, at that distance. If we consider that the object that we're talking about, the boomerang, was in low Earth orbit or a couple 100 miles away, it's bigger than a plane, a lot bigger than a plane.
Wow.
If we consider that it's further than that, this is one of the weird objects. See, all the things that I catch in Earth orbit are, you could draw a ruler line perfectly straight in the editor, and they will follow that because they are in orbit. This object is free flying, so we have no way to really judge Was this in Earth orbit? Doesn't even look like it's in orbit. It looks like it's free flying. You know, the Huffington Post covered one of my clips a while back, and you know, I had to do a rebuttal to show that what they had said about the clip was just an error. And I did this by talking with an optics expert at the scope shop to determine the actual distance of a pixel at my camera at 11,000 miles, which is halfway to geosynchronous. And I demonstrated, you know, they were claiming that I was looking at a satellite halfway to geosynchronous orbit based on the speed, which is a legitimate calculation. That's how I would have done it. But the problem becomes, knowing the pixel value, this thing was three times the size of the International Space Station, or, you know, that supposed station that we are told about. And I don't buy for a second that I'm filming something that's three times that big. I mean, how do they get it up there, for one?
Dang. That's an intense one, and it looks very clear and very interesting. That's one of my favorites that I'd seen. So I want to get into the major thing that you've captured. This is the thing that people are calling, or that you call, the lunar wave. It's created quite a buzz. People are very interested in it, but also people are very polarized in their opinion of it, it seems to be. But explain to the people what you captured. How do you introduce people to the lunar wave?
Very carefully.
Right.
Not an easy thing, because it is so far outside of any reference point the average human has to associate. And so let me tell you what happened the night I filmed it, and let me tell you what I did in the following weeks, and it will help you to understand that not only was I exactly where, you know, people view a video once and they draw a conclusion. You know, that's what YouTube is about. Very few people take the time to go back and study over and over a clip. But it was back in 2012. It was on the 26th of September, just a few days past the fall equinox. And I should preface that every wave that I have filmed has either been right after an equinox or right before the spring equinox. So I filmed the first one in 2012. I didn't see anything again until the spring equinox of 2014, and I was filming right along the whole time. So I'm filming that night. By chance, when I film, I keep my camera centered on the moon, because it takes endless hours. You're out there, you get bored, you just want to increase your odds. So I don't move the camera much. For some reason, I panned the camera down below the moon, and the wave started. Now, I didn't see that, but when I panned up above the wave caught up to the camera, which has always proved that it's a filmed event. But at the time, I saw it, and my immediate reaction was, my camera's failing. So I reached over to delete the clip, but for some reason I didn't, which is also odd. So now I've panned my camera in a strange way that I've never really done since or before, and I reached over to delete a clip, which when I do it, I do it, and for some reason I didn't. Had I done that, it would have been unretrievable. So I filmed on that night, and that clip gnawed on me in the back of my mind. I kept going back, looking at it, thinking, okay, camera failure. Well, I've got a degree in internet technology, and what was gnawing on me in the back of my mind is digital equipment doesn't fail in an organic way.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't. You know, you see pixelation, signal shredding, all these kinds of things associated with losing a digital signal. So I think a month or more went by, and finally one day I went in, looked at it, and I just said, the hell with it. I deleted the clip. That night, as I laid down for bed, I had the epiphany, and I ran out to the computer, booted it up, restored the clip out of my trash can, and it scared me, because I realized all at once what the camera pan meant. The camera pan had proved that it was a filmed event, and it was very fortunate, because had that not been part of the clip, there would have been no way to address any of the other nine that have been filmed to date that we know of now, because so many people will just say it's atmosphere, it's camera, it's, you know, they'll say what they want. But that fortunate camera pan gave me a benchmark to consider. So that's how I first dealt with the wave, thinking that it was equipment failure. So then after that, of course, comes endless hours of reviewing, examining, studying, measuring, talking to other people, letting very smart people see the clip. And, you know, not before long, I've talked to a guy who designed CCD chips, who's saying, yeah, that's a filmed event. along the course, well, it's like the third video or so I posted on my channel, and I realized there was something special about it by the reaction I got, because I got contacted by, first, one of the observatories in one of the stands, Kyrgyzstan, or I forget which country, but they read me the riot act on how irresponsible and unscientific I was for saying things I had said. And this didn't stop. This kept going on. So I realized there's got to be, you know, there's something going on with this clip.
Right. Yeah.
Well, further down the line, a video engineer views it and he says, you know, you can use luma, gamma, and noise to try to prove that the wave doesn't cross the video frame, which I do. And sure enough, you can see the wave is not going beyond the edge of the moon. So I tried to encode that clip. It takes hours and hours and hours, and by the time YouTube's done with it, it just looks like noise with a bright spot in the middle. So what I did is I ended up masking out the moon, adding noise and making it black and white, and putting up a lesser version of that that would encode, which is on my channel now. Two of the clips were shot early enough in the night that there's enough ambient light that you can show the wave is not crossing the video frame but staying at the edge of the moon. But in the 2012 footage, maybe a year in, when I got better video tools to edit with and I had stepped up my game there, I started to run some filters and we realized it looked like there was some kind of like a little invisible, almost like a cloaked ship or something, skirting across right before the wave starts. So we started running fine edge filters and things like this, and it became instantly visible that there's an energy pulse that hits the lower left limb of the moon right before the wave starts, and then a lateral energy pulse sweeps from left to right as the wave is beginning, and then 4 seconds later, a shadow goes across the upper left limb of the moon, which I had assumed was a bird, and you know, by this time I'm thinking, well, maybe this isn't a coincidence. As it turns out, in I think two other filmings of the wave, we have seen this shadow that looks enough like a bird that it's hard to make a claim beyond, but it seems to be more than coincidence. So, you know, anyone who looks at maybe the latest clip on this, where I've got all nine posted, there's four other people that have shot this now to date. Two of them were not even aware that it was in their footage. Users on my channel who had been following me spotted it and brought it to light. It's the real deal. There's something going on, and we have not been told about it. And this clip seems to hit a nerve out there in the world. So that's what I can tell you.
Yeah, man. It is definitely fascinating. And for people who haven't seen it, just to clarify a little bit, we're talking about, you know, you're filming the moon, you know, you got the big full moon, and then we have this solid, straight across, transparent wave that just kind of sweeps across the entire footprint or the entire surface of the moon, like, you know, a guy washing a window, like this little, this sweep straight across. Is that kind of how you describe it to people who might not have seen the clip?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, you can see the bow. In the 2012 footage, which is miles ahead of all other footage that's been captured, it's just by chance the best footage. In that footage, you can see as it crosses the equator of the moon, there's a bow. You know, you can see that it's going around something round, but the waves always come in pairs, and they don't always come from the same direction. And to top it off, you know, we were filming one of the two recent lunar eclipses, and I spotted the wave in the middle of a lunar eclipse. Very subtle. The other thing to note is when I first filmed it in 2012, every subsequent capture has been a faster wave, a clearer, a harder to detect wave, and many have argued that someone out there knows you filmed it and they're trying to make it harder to see. It almost looks like a organic, old-fashioned video signal reset. It almost looks like if you would film like off an old tube TV, the effect you would get, but the problem is it's just on the moon.
Right.
And you know, the energy pulse really brings that home. You can just see the curvature of the lines when the filters are applied. You know, there's no doubt in my mind what I think I'm looking at.
Yeah, I've tried to describe it to my girlfriend who hasn't seen it because I was explaining the show I'm going to do today, and I explained it by saying, like, those old, the old VHS tapes, when you would hit the tracking on them, those tracking buttons, and you'd get that one line that goes across the whole screen. It's like that, but it only covers the moon. And yeah, the videos that I've seen, it is at night, so it's kind of hard maybe to see against a black background. But like you said, you have some that have some ambient light. But I still think, even with a black background, it's easy to see that there's no disturbance in the space around the moon. It's just this one thing that sweeps across and the entire surface of the moon, and it's not existent anywhere else in the frame. Very compelling, very mysterious. What do you think that means? What do you think you're capturing there?
Well, I would also add one more thing about the appearance for those who haven't seen it, is we get that glass of water effect where, as the wave is traveling, it very slightly displaces the lunar features as it goes by, almost like you're looking through a glass of water and you just move that glass of water a little bit. So that's part of it. What I think we're looking at is artificial. Now, the second I say that, the argument for me becomes very hard, because now they're going to say the moon's been there forever, thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, whatever. We didn't have holograms back in the day. Well, be that as it may, I have spent endless hours with my wife observing the moon every month since 2012. And we can tell when we first set up that we are looking at something that is not the same as it is on a say, a different night. The problem with that is to see it live unencoded on an HD monitor with an eyepiece is not the same as looking at video. When you look at video, then, you know, you've got lighting, contrast, color, all these things come into play, which are going to obscure the point that I'm trying to make here. So I really haven't tried to, but I can tell you this. Every time NASA has said they're going to be in orbit at the moon, every time the Chinese have said we're going to have something up at the moon, we're going to land on the moon, we're going to orbit the moon, we're going to crash something into the moon, my scope has been there, and we have seen nothing. And to top it off, I'm getting ready to do some experiments, and one of them is going to show that if I take my scope and shoot a mountain that's 5-10 miles away, there's atmospheric disturbance in between me and that mountain. It's not crystal clear, and the further away it gets, the more that is. That's never the case with the moon. Every time you look at the moon, if it's not overcast, it's crystal clear. But this wave is artificial. There is no doubt in my mind it's artificial. I have said in some of my clips early on that I thought maybe it was a hologram covering the surface of the moon, so that we couldn't see what was going on. But since then, I've come to the point where I doubt everything we've been told about the moon. And this is just based on a lot of filming, a lot of experience, and a lot of deductive reasoning. And so at this point, I'm willing to say I'm 100% sure that we're looking at something artificial. I don't know the cause of it. I don't know who's doing it. But I do know in my heart of hearts that the moon is not what you have been told it is.
Wow. And that is definitely far out. But just to clarify, we're talking about not just the lunar wave is artificial, but when you look up at the moon at the sky, do you think that whole ball that we're looking at could be a fabrication?
Here's what happens in life. You know, if you talk to a physicist and he starts talking really high-minded physics to you, as a human being, your response is to say, you know what, I don't understand what he's talking about. He's the expert. I'll go with what he says.
Right.
That's human nature. The problem is that when you say, hey, I'm a human being, I can think, I can do these things, and you go out and make your own observations and your own studies, everything you've been told starts becoming a problem. I mean, everything you've been told starts becoming a problem. And the real problem is trying to convey that to other people, because they are in a mindset where, well, wait a minute, in school they told me this, experts have told me this, NASA says this. That's the problem. You know, go out and do observations on your own. There's a man named Bill Bryson who viewed the moon for many thousands of hours. He, in between Bible study, you know, he would go to Bible study, talked about on his channel, and then he would come home and film the moon. And when he started getting objects, his initial reaction and his in his frame of reference was that he was filming Fallen Angels. That's what the little vehicles or whatever they were that he started to film. As he went on, he was doing real close-up work with homemade, really high-tech cameras and stuff. He came to the conclusion that the mare, or the mares, the seas on the moon, are see-through, and that he could see cities beneath them. Well, while I don't necessarily agree nose-to-nose, what I do agree with is that when you take the time to observe for yourself, you will realize that things are not exactly how you've been told they are.
Right. So this is all fascinating. So do you think the lunar wave itself, this line that goes across it, do you think that is a glitch in the hologram that reveals to us that it's a hologram?
It could be something like that. There's so many logical problems, though, because then we have to say, okay, well, this must have been going on for quite some time. How come more people haven't filmed it? Why only nine?
Right.
Well, part of the key to that is that two of the people that have provided me footage didn't even understand that what was in their footage was of value. So that's the first thing. And the second part of that is that I've got a lot of experience, yet the first time I filmed it, I said the camera messed up and I almost deleted the clip for good. So that kind of starts to address it, but the real problem comes in with all the objects I've been filming. As I started to calculate pixel distances, you know, what a pixel's distance across and square, you know, in feet is at certain distances from my scope, I began to realize that these objects I'm shooting are too big. And then I started realizing that many of these objects that I shoot have like a speed blur. And this is like satellites that I can identify, that you can look up and know it's this satellite. I've got a number of those that I've filmed, and yet they're going so fast that they have like a see-through speed blur on them. And you can tell, they look kind of like you think they should look. They're listed right there. Yep, this satellite should be coming by at about this speed. Very likely that you're looking at what you think you're looking at. And so I came to the conclusion, these satellites are not as high as we've been told, because at those distances, speed blur shouldn't even enter into the picture.
Hmm. Man, so is there any chance maybe, like, have you considered something like maybe it's a magnetic or energetic effect, like some type of wave of gravity or some type of ley line energy or anything like that that might exist that we just aren't aware of?
So, yeah, you know, of the many hundreds of hours that this clip has been studied by people much smarter than I'll ever be, coronal mass ejections from the sun have been looked at. The description you just gave has been considered. But when you take it to its logical conclusion, when you say it's a natural event, then you're faced with the same problem that I addressed a couple minutes ago. Well, if this is a natural event, how come we haven't been told about it? How come it hasn't been filmed endlessly? Any natural event like that should be on film and should have a description from our fraudulent space agencies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's in nature, we should know about it if it's observable, and this is clearly observable. So, I mean, the logical problem that crops up is, if this is natural, why haven't we been told about it? Why hasn't it been filmed endlessly?
Yeah, it is so strange. But it is hard to rectify that, at least in my mind, man has been looking at the moon for hundreds and hundreds of years. Galileo's looking at it. Yeah, it's hard to rectify that it would be a hologram, because how old would that technology have to be?
Yeah, but it's also possible that the sky we see now is not the sky we saw some indeterminate time back.
That's true.
But I would point out, there are ancient texts, I believe some of them Roman, that talk about before the moon people came, a time before the moon. There are older texts that you can read that talk about a time with two moons. I mean, so the problem becomes, what's a legitimate source to think about and what isn't? And that will always be the problem.
You're right. And I thought that was really fascinating, some of those stories you've had in one of your videos. You talked about several of them, these old ancient texts that talk about the sky as even a dome. They talk about some type of barrier above the sky. They talk about the idea that the stars are almost like nails in the ceiling.
Yep.
Of our sky. And that's pretty trippy stuff.
Well, I see, we as a race on this planet have been taught, at least in the part of the world where I live, that time is linear. It's this thing you go down. And it's a foregone conclusion that people are back in time, did not have the technology or even the ability to think like we do now. I don't buy into that. I look at ancient megalithic structures and I'm in awe because I know for a fact that some of those things we can't replicate with everything we've got right now, never mind the precision and engineering that went into it. So I don't consider for a second that ancient people had any less cognitive ability and may well have had quite a bit more because they were just simply closer to nature than we are. Mm-hmm. We're very separated from nature. We don't even know what the date is, for crying out loud.
You're right.
You know, somebody decided to zero that out for us a couple thousand years ago for Lord knows what reason. But the point I'm making is if you look at those ancient texts, in my mind, I feel like I'm getting a view that doesn't have the modern edit, the modern mindset, you know, all these things that we see, like when you pick up a National Geographic now and you say, crap, I can barely read this anymore. I read it in the 80s and now it seems like it's a kid's book. Just the modern kind of twist that is put on all the writings and things that we see these days. When I look at those old things, I feel like I get a glimpse that I wouldn't otherwise have. And I think you referenced Omar Khayyam. And these are important texts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the initiated groups, those were a big deal. Since I'm not in an initiated group, I guess I'll never know why it's a big deal to them. But nonetheless, when I read those words, I feel like I'm getting an insight that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And, you know, I would say to everyone, read Omar Khayyam, if nothing else. Read the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, because the way he talks about the sky makes you think.
Right. And like you said, the conventional view of history is that people have just gotten progressively better and advanced. And if you look back at the things people were saying in ancient times, oh, well, they were just ignorant. They have no idea what was going on. Of course, they think there's a dome in the sky. They can't send a satellite out there. They don't have rocketry. They don't have modern technology. And I think that is very dismissive. It's a clever way to kind of put those people down. But when you look at something like NASA, what would you say that if this were to be true, NASA's entire function would have to be to create this entire false reality around what space could be?
Well, you know, this is, you're going to force me to say one of the things I guess I don't generally say too much in public because I know that it's going to hit a lot of ears in a way that's not helpful. But in my view, from what I have learned from firsthand observation, NASA's mission has never been science. NASA's mission is to ensure that we do not know next to anything about what's 100 miles or more above our head. They have been caught endlessly lying. You know, I did a clip not far back on this whole Rosetta mission. It's for anyone who still has the ability to critically think and look at what they're being presented with, you will understand very quickly that that is shenanigans. It's made out of whole cloth. There is nothing real about it. And when you further look into the images we're given on that particular mission, their camera and all their infinite wisdom was 4 megapixels. So they spent $100 million on a camera, and they gave us 4 megapixels. That's what they went out into space with. And, you know, people come to my channel all the time, and it never ceases to amaze me that someone will ask an honest question like one I heard recently: how can a rocket work in the vacuum of space? There's nothing for it to thrust against. In my mind, that should be legitimately talked about.
Right.
But what we see in the comments section is, oh God, break out the tinfoil hats. We got another one here. And this is one of the big problems with the modern age. If someone brings up a topic, you should address it. I mean, sure, some things are beyond the pale, but a question like that, to me, is a reasonable question.
I would think so, too. And it might sound super far out that NASA would be created for this purpose, but we have examined on this show the Smithsonian in the past and how they've taken a lot of anomalous artifacts from the early United States and they have suppressed them, including giant bones that have been discovered by the thousands, yet they don't ever make it to display. So we have the situation where the Smithsonian is considered the institution of, you know, that chronologizes history, and yet it's like limited hangout because they show us some things and they say, oh, this is all we got. But yet the real stuff is buried beneath. And NASA could also provide that false sense of security for space. They're like the Smithsonian of space, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting line in the beginning of one of the Indiana Jones movies where Indy is teaching his class. He looks out to his class and he says, don't come here to do archaeology looking for truth, because archaeology is not going to give you truth. It gives you facts. If you want truth, go down the hall to the philosophy class. You know, it's these small little castaway lines that are blurted here and there that don't seem to mean much, which really mean something. And it's unfortunate that people don't catch them going by. There was a guy on one of my channels not long ago making the argument that there is not a museum in the world with a real dinosaur skull. And I thought, well, that's an interesting claim. And I thought, I'll have to go look at that. I haven't had time yet, but that's the kind of guy I want to talk to. The guy who's thinking on his own two feet. Maybe there's something to it, maybe there's not. But the point is, he's not just regurgitating what he's been handed all his life. And I think that most people agree that one of the peculiar things about the age we live in right now is it's a very deceptive age.
Oh, I totally agree. And this also spills over into false flag events, or when a tragic event happens, immediately now the knee-jerk response is false flag, didn't happen. And yes, you don't want to be jumping to conclusions prematurely, but I would argue that it is better for the knee-jerk reaction to be the news is lying to me rather than the news is telling me the truth. So I guess we're dealing with growing pains and deciding what is true and what is fiction, but I don't mind that the default reaction is you better prove to me that this happened before you just tell me.
Well, I don't see any problem with that. I think that should be the out-of-the-box response to everything.
Yeah.
I live my life by the rule where I will believe nothing, unless I have a damn good reason to do so. And I went through, some years ago, my epiphany where I made the decision to throw out everything I had ever learned. And it is not an easy thing to do because it leaves you without a point of reference. And you find yourself slipping back and clinging on to these things that you've been told your whole life. But if you can pull that off for 6 months or a year, a whole new reality opens up where you see things in a whole other way. And as far as the news is concerned, I have no compulsion to tell anyone that if it came from your news, it is not just worthless. At its best, it is agenda and propaganda. That's what it is.
Right.
There's no doubt. And the real truth is if you take some event like Sandy Hook, which has been pretty well documented to be shenanigans, if you can accept that this has happened once, are you the kind of person that is going to cling to your old ideals and say, well, it happened once? Or are you going to come to the realization where, you know, if I see one bunny, there's more bunnies on this planet, you know, because that's really what this is about. You know, things do not happen in a vacuum.
Right. Man, so let's assume that the lunar wave is evidence of a glitch in the hologram that is the moon. And then let's also assume that some of these ancient writings we were talking about have some legitimacy. For people who still might not be very clear on it, what do you think the real composition of our sky is? Like, if you had to say, if you took away all the manipulation and tried to get down to the truth, what is up there? Is there no space? Is it a dome? What do you think it might be?
I you know, the honest answer is I don't know. I am arriving at the conclusion that we do not leave low Earth orbit. That's not set in stone, and I am working feverishly to get some evidence that can help to solidify this, some firsthand evidence that I can gather, or some experiment that I can run, or some logical deduction I can apply. But I am very close to being convinced that space is nothing like we've been told. But to say that doesn't mean much when you can't follow up with, this is what it is. And unfortunately, I can't do that. I don't know. I can't go there. I'm stuck like an ant on the ground like the rest of us, and I have to figure out a way from my minuscule vantage point to deal with this. You know, not too long ago, I shot what looks to be some sort of a spaceship with thrusters that just happened to come through my field of view, and I took that as a very important clip because the size of it, just what we were seeing, it was clearly had thrusters of some sort, and it brought up all these questions like, if that thing's 200 miles away and those thrusters are that big, what kind of fuel would that thing be burning? And, you know, it makes you begin to reconsider, how far away is this thing? Is it in low Earth orbit? I guess the short answer is I'm not sure how to address it. I don't know what's out there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, to think that the reality could be this different, I mean, it throws a whole lot of things into the manipulation column if it were to be true. I mean, the whole composition of our solar system, the model we have for the planets, the orbits, I mean, the constellations, if all that stuff could be somehow not real, I mean, that's a pretty far out thought.
It is, but I mean, there were times when reality was talked about in different ways, and I suppose there's probably spiritual sects on the planet that still think in this way, but even the movie The Matrix kind of brings this home to people that reality is made by, you know, your mentality. Your mind creates the reality. And so if that is true, it really adds a whole nother ocean that you can't see the bottom of to think about.
Right.
And when you think about the media, just ensuring that, you know, the population of this planet goes out and bases everything they regurgitate and every decision they make in error. It's just like the old computer cliche, you know, bad information in, bad information out. If you're in the ruling class of this planet and you want to control a population, one of the easiest ways would be to ensure that everyone's basing everything they say and do on erroneous information.
Right.
If you're the ruling class and you had good information, that would be one heck of an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you make everybody's foundation inaccurate, they got nowhere to go. They're just lost in the forest before they even know that they need a map.
That's right.
And we're getting pretty close to the end of the show here. Are there any other secrets or things that you've been able to, that you might have stumbled upon in your research that you think are worth mentioning that we might not have touched on before we start wrapping this up?
Not that I'm really ready to divulge yet. My intent is to do a series of kind of logical clips before too much more time goes by to try to demonstrate something particular about the moon. I don't know how that will come out, but I've got an idea of how to proceed. Other than that, you know, the one thing I would also mention, I guess, is I see a lot of people hating the Masons, hating the Illuminati, if that's even a thing, hating all these people. And I can tell you, I'm reasonably sure that they are all encoding and using the same information from a very distant ancient source, and a lot of it has to do with the sun. I do not believe the information is evil. I believe the information is like anything else on this planet. You can use it for bad or use it for good. Mm-hmm. I consider what I'm trying to discover, including things about the sun, as my birthright. And I consider that the people who misuse it are simply taking valuable information and using it in a negative way. So That's what I would add.
Well said. And I agree with you. We talk to people who have studied that stuff, and they kind of talk about sacred geometry and the enlightening nature of it.
Right.
And I totally agree. It can be used for either or, just like a hammer. I could bash your head in or build you a house. It's really up to me.
That's right.
Well, this has been fascinating, man. Definitely a far out idea. We explored some unique concepts and some big secrets to keep, but that lunar wave footage definitely makes you think twice. Would you like to remind the people where they can check out your work before we go?
You can catch me on YouTube as Crow777. There are two R's in the word crow, so it's CRROW777, and that's primarily my main source of online communication. I have a Facebook account, but I don't use it because I don't appreciate Facebook.
Right on. Well, very cool. I do appreciate your time. This has been very awesome and a lot of fun. Take care of yourself out there, Crow.
Hey, thanks for having me, and have a great day.
There we have it, party people. Another one in the bag. I love that first hour, but in the second hour, we talk more about comets and asteroids, Ison and Rosetta, the problems Crow had with that stuff, Crow's footage on Jupiter turning blue, the references to ancient Egypt and mythology that NASA uses to name their missions and probes, and the possible reasons for that, Crow's reasons for not buying the moon landing, problems Crow sees with the footage and pictures that we get of the Earth and the moon from space, insights Crow's background as a radio operator has given him about the concerns and dangers and health effects of radio waves and wireless signals and Wi-Fi. More talk about poisons in our society, another suppressed alternative cancer cure, and more speculation about space, the lunar wave, and reality itself. All in all, I think this is a great show, and I hope for the next month, every time you look at the moon, you think, is that thing real? Is that thing real? Then I'll know I've done my job. See, I know it's strange, but it's fresh and different, and that's what I love about it. It's not a lot to go on. Even Crow would admit that, but he makes a good point. If you can't see it and touch it, how can you take it off the table in this backwards world? But then you wonder where you draw the line. I mean, you say I'm breathing oxygen, but I don't see anything. You say there's this gravity thing, but I don't know what that is. You say that the sun is a massive incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, but it just looks like a light bulb to me. Of course, it can get a little bit ridiculous, but you have to try to find your own truth without devolving into madness. Not always an easy task. So let me be your guide. And as for THC, you know, a big part of doing a show like this is authors making the media rounds. And when that occurs, I hope listeners think I do a better than average job with those shows. But there's more to it that I want to accomplish here. I want to look under the rocks and find people who haven't talked much about their findings or ideas. I've even been talking to a few guests and listeners who speak other languages that might be able to find interesting nuggets, interesting books written in other languages, guests that might not even speak English that I would be willing to communicate with through a translator and then edit it so it's not inconvenient for the listener, but we could get into some really crazy out-of-the-box stuff that I would love to do. It's just knowing where to look and having those people come to us. Sometimes people ask me what the goal of THC is, or they'll come at me with a position or purpose that is way off the mark from my true goals and ideas, and it makes me think that sometimes I'm not clear, and that is what it is. But let's look at today. A perfect recipe for me, a well-spoken guest, that's key. A guy who's not positive of his work, not condescending, not shut off from other possibilities, not cocky, great tone and approach, also important. And the third pillar, bringing something to the table that many of us have never considered. New ideas. And today I think we hit that trifecta. And that's the model I'd like to apply to all kinds of different subjects that we cover. I think we've done a great job with magic lately. Last week's cryptid show is good. But it's not always easy to get that perfect recipe. We are going to do a lot more shows on topics where you will probably right out of the gate be like, what? No way. And then hopefully I can help my guests make the case for X, Y, or Z along the way, but it's a fine line between what's worth exploring and what's too far, and we are going to flirt with that line, because it's fun. And this show is about entertainment and inspiration and exploration and fun, because none of it's worth doing if we don't have a gay old time, right? Also, sometimes I get messages or comments about not liking a topic before they've even heard the episode, just based off the title. And I hope by now, after 150 episodes or so, that you just learn to kind of trust me a little bit. Granted, I'm going to strike out once in a while. It will happen. But I think you'll find that even when a topic doesn't immediately sound exciting, doesn't immediately resonate with your eternal being, it ends up being better than you might have thought. Maybe. I don't know. But that's the show. Please sign up for Plus if you'd like to help me out and get twice as much show. I mentioned last week that something big is in the works with a very popular researcher into ancient sites, and I might be going out of the country and right into the action this summer, and it's only going to work if I can afford to do it, which is really up to people getting THC+. And when this happens, I'm definitely going to do some filming and put something together that would be a gift for the Plus people, the actual individuals who made it possible. And again, this is about trusting me as a host and a guy of integrity. Conspiracy projects are notorious for being hyped up and then just completely falling apart and nothing happens. And I do not want to be in that category. But once I have some extra money from THC+, I'm going to use it, yes, to enjoy my life and the career that's been built here, but also in a lot of ways that create extra enjoyment and entertainment for the people supporting it. We might be able to make some real differences down the line. I've got some really out there ideas. And who knows how it's going to go? And who knows for how many years we'll do it? But more members means more options, and that's just the simple equation. And that's enough math from me. I really do love you guys. Let's keep doing this for a long time. Tell your friends about THC. Tell your favorite speakers and conspiracy researchers that they need to be coming on THC to get their material seen in the best light with a good host who will help them navigate these rough waters of the airwaves. We gotta stop messing around and release the hounds. All right, I've done what I can do. Your move, operators of the big Vatican moon projector. Your frickin' move.
Sweet dreams to the elite. We're calling them out on THC. Uncovering secrets and conspiracies. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to abuse you. Some of them want to be abused.